The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're listening to the Fade to Gray Network.
We invite people of all backgrounds
to share their stories.
Their nuanced conversations.
And forward thinking.
And not taking ourselves too seriously.
Everyone's story matters.
Every voice is important.
Life is polarizing.
But not everything is black and white.
Come join us
as we fade to gray.
Okay, welcome back to another episode of Fade to Gray. And it's the health series that we're doing, you guys. Hope you're enjoying it. We've had some real quality guests and quality content so far. I've been kind of blown away. And hopefully here we go again today, because we have Jed Payne in the house. And
Hello.
He's a friend of the family. This is probably like, what, the third or fourth time you've been on a Fade to Gray episode?
I think third.
Right on. Well, it's...
I think that's a record.
Is it?
Yeah.
Nice.
I think so.
Yeah, I think
MVP.
So...
Yeah.
We like you, so I'm glad you're here. Even though our teams are playing each other today, it's Sunday and the Panthers are playing the Saints. I know some people right now are already bored with the podcast, but don't worry. We're not going to talk about football.
And may I just say, as a non-sports person, major props to both Omar and Jed today are coming on to this call right now as both of their teams duel it out tied in, what, is it the fourth quarter?
Yeah.
Yep, it is the fourth quarter. I'm watching out of the corner of my eye.
I mean, it's do or die. It's do or die for my team right now, too. So,
and
I mean,
they're podcasting, everyone. This is called dedication to the art form. So let's just give them some props here, because I know this is not easy.
So
it's not. The Panthers are going to lose, though, so it's all good.
Well, you can hear on the call we have Seth, obviously. Say hi, Seth. We already heard your voice.
What's up? You've heard me.
Elizabeth.
Hey, hey.
Yeah, she's on this one. And we have Jed. And so
yep.
Today we're going to be talking mental health as far as the health series go, and like really spotlight the area of addiction and recovery. We'll hear a little bit of Jed's story. If you want to hear more, obviously, he has his own podcast called The Church and Other Drugs. He is 5 years sober at this point and been a drug and alcohol counselor for 2.5 years. And so we'll get to hear a little more about that. And obviously, we have our resident shrink with Seth and you know, we have Elizabeth to talk about, you know, depression and all the different things that are connected with getting clean and staying sober. So, all right, here we go. I'm very glad to have you, Jed.
Oh, yeah.
Jed, I really am honored to have you back on the podcast. And each time that you're on, I feel like we've talked about different things. And this topic that we're going to discuss today is very important to me personally. I've gone through my own path of mental health concerns and substance abuse. And so I'm really honored to be able to talk with you about this today. Since you have been a substance abuse counselor for 2.5 years and you've been sober for 5, tell us a little bit about your story. I kind of want to know how you got to where you are today and providing the type of assistance and help to people who are struggling. So tell us. Tell us your story.
Yeah. Well, I'll have to... have to be sort of truncated, right?
Because it's
extremely long. In kind of a nutshell, I mean, I started smoking cigarettes first. Cigarettes are the real gateway drug, if there is such a thing. I would thoroughly contend that cigarettes are that. Started smoking weed early on, and then my parents started drug. I got caught for weed, so they started drug testing me. But this was like the advent of the internet age, so I just started researching things that wouldn't show up on a drug test. This is kind of irony how like intervention turned, like, kind of made it worse, because then I just started doing like Benadryl and cough medicine. So I had my first overdose on Benadryl.
Robo tripping then, huh?
Yes, 15? Absolutely. That was my
an overdose. An overdose choice. Like, I can see, I can see like starting to engage like those things, but an overdose is pretty serious. At that,
well, and it was so it was it wasn't it was an overdose in that I was like, Benadryl is a deliriant, so it's like a. It's hallucinations that you have no idea are fake. It's basically like I'd be talking to you, except you're not there. It's like the only true drug I've done where it's like it's complete detachment from reality. So it wasn't that like I like was in danger of dying. I was just completely gone, and my parents had no idea what I was on. I wasn't able to tell them what I was on either, so they took me to the hospital.
That's
a good decision.
Kids, stay away from that. It's one of the worst trips I've ever done. I did it once, and I'll never forget. Like, you know, it was obviously a Robitussin, and it's over-the-counter stuff, you know, and you pretty much have to down an entire bottle, and it, I ended up, you know, yakking it back out in the parking lot of, I believe it was a Wendy's, and wasn't feeling right at all. Ended up going to a friend's house who I've never been to, ended up in the bathroom, like, right away, you know, just... I think coming out both ends, and then by the time it was all said and done, I look up at the wallpaper and it was just moving. And I'd never been to this house before in my life, and so it just a horrible, horrible experience. So
that sounds terrifying.
It's a real deal thing too. So yeah, and like the stuff that's in cough medicine is dextromethorphan, and that PCP and ketamine are all sister drugs in the dissociative anesthetic class. So it's actually like, it's an extremely strong chemical. Anyway, though, so that's how I wound up in my first... back then, I went to outpatient treatment. And outpatient adolescent treatment didn't take it seriously. Well, I took it, I guess, as seriously as I could at 15 with, like, no real consequences yet.
Are we talking outpatient, like, once a week? Or are we talking, like, IOP, intensive outpatient?
IOP.
Like, three to five times
a week. Was... To my poor father, it was at the hospital that he worked at, too.
Oh. So,
yeah. So that, I'm sure, in retrospect, that must have been horribly, horribly embarrassing for him.
So is your dad a doctor then?
No, he does human resources.
Okay, right on. I never knew that your dad worked at the hospital.
Yeah, well, back then he did. Yeah, he did human resources for hospitals for years. And I would often end up at those hospitals, so it must have been... kind of tough for him, but so that was kind of my first introduction to, so, and before that, like, I had since we're talking about mental health, I had I've always had mental health issues, and I got diagnosed with Tourette's syndrome when I was 11. I was, before that, it was like generalized anxiety and like separation anxiety. Not much depression yet, but then I got my anxiety manifested in facial tics really bad, which I then got made fun of for, which then compounded the anxiety and all that. So I had like a perfect storm of mental health stuff. And when I finally discovered drugs, it really did like relieve that at first. So
that's the trick.
Yeah. So I what's that?
That's the trick with drugs. Is that they are effective.
Yes.
They do.
Extremely. They work at first.
They do work initially, but not in the long term.
Right. And then eventually they start creating the symptoms that you wanted to cure in the first place. But so I had always been familiar with doctors, and I'd been, man, I think I went to a therapist when I was like 8, 9, 10, somewhere around there, like really young. So I'd been in that kind of world of diagnoses and medicine and all that sort of stuff. So then I started going to treatment, and I got out of that treatment, and of course things just escalated. Started doing harder and harder drugs. And at first it was really, I sought it out. I was really into, which I kind of figured out. I guess it was a natural extension of like my childhood, because I was the kind of kid that I would go see a movie like Power Rangers or something, and then for that week I would pretend to be a Power Ranger, right? And I was very into like identity swapping, and like that was how I played. And so when I got into high school, I got into like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and started listening to Modest Mouse. And so I got into that culture, and that's, you know, looking back, that's kind of what I did, was then I just started playing that, really, but I was actually doing drugs. So like I had no idea what I was messing with at first. I thought I did, and I thought it was fun and cool, and I idolized, like, I'm an artist and a creative, and I thought it, you know, I make better art and I can write better and all those, you know, kind of lies that you fall for, which, I mean, I guess you can make good art on it, but it's not better or worse or whatever. So I kind of purposely sought out drugs. And
let me interrupt you real quick, Jed, and say I agree, because you've been clean for 5 years, and this is my opportunity just to plug you and say you do make amazing art. If you don't follow Jed on Instagram or Facebook, you know you should. If you haven't seen any of the stuff he does, like Comic Con, a lot of it's I don't know what kind of base paint it is, but maybe talk a little bit about that for a second, and then keep telling your story.
Yeah. It's jed.i.am on Instagram. Me and my wife do stuff. I just do a ton of like pop culture art and painting and drawing and digital media and stuff like that. And it is, yeah, turns out I'm much better at sober. I've looked at my art when I was, especially on meth, and it's horrible. I thought it was so good too. And it was like, why didn't anybody tell me it was so awful?
That's the thing about meth. It seems like it's like the problems with everybody else. It's not with you, not with me. You know, I'm right. Everybody else is wrong. But
yeah, like full tilt mania. So basically, though, things got worse to the point when I was a senior in high school. Things were bad enough that I needed to go to an inpatient treatment center, and I got put on a waiting list. And during that time, I was like, well, I'm going to have to quit drugs, so I better... I have my old journal. I wonder if I have it. So I have an old... I had a checklist of drugs that I had done. Like, that's, like, what... Like, that's a view into, like, my mind and, like, how serious I
thought. Wow, at least you're organized about it.
Yeah, but it was like my bragging rights or whatever it was.
Wow.
But I was like, I've never done heroin, so I need to try that before I go to rehab, right? That the logic tracks on that. So I did, and my plan was I'm only gonna snort it. And then the people I got it from, they're like, why don't you just shoot it? And apparently that was all it took, and I was like, okay, well, you'll have to do it for me. And they did, and that was a wrap on that, you know. Fell in love with that, as anyone would if they, you know, if that's, turns out it's addictive, because it's crazy addictive, right?
I was in a educational breakout session at my old job, where I had to go to this training, and they did a talk on heroin, to where like, at the greatest pleasure centers of our brain, like what we can imagine, like it, on a scale of like 1 to 10, okay, sex is like a 10. But when you're on heroin, it's like 44,000 of those. That it is so beyond, it hits every pleasure center in the brain in such a way that it's unlike anything a person can experience. So when a person does heroin, that's the whole problem, is that it's too good or something like that. It's been a couple of years, but I just remember a talk on that, and I was thinking of that as you were talking about heroin.
I was always able to stay away from it because it killed all my heroes growing up. And so I was just like,
I was the opposite. See, if you couple that with, I've been suicidal also for as long as I can remember.
The good die young, then is your health.
Yes. Yeah, then it becomes, yeah, the whole, the motto for my crew back then was like, what was it? live fast, die young, leave a pretty corpse. Like, my friend had that tattooed on his knuckle.
That's a lot to have tattooed on your... I mean, he had big hands.
No, well, he had what was it? He had look good, die young, or like L, whatever. The abbreviations on both his hands, however it fits. Fact check me on that. But... Yeah, that was the whole thing. It was like, I didn't plan on living past 21. Like, I didn't want to. I resented my dad for having a stable job. I thought that shit was for the birds, all that sort of stuff. All the trappings of youth, right? I thought that was stupid, and I didn't want any of it, and I assumed I was going to die young anyway. And because of my Christianity, I assumed I'd just go to heaven, you know? So, that, like, literally, this was my thinking. It was like... I'm tired of this. Let's just move on to the next
thing. It seems like you're rebellion. I mean, have you had a chance to, like, really, like, you know, since you've gotten older, looking back, do you know what you're rebelling from? I mean, or do you think it was just natural curiosity? Was it not rebellion at all?
No, it probably, it was, like, if anything, it was like the classic suburban white kid rebellion. Like, you know, I had no, I mean, you know what, that is like a thing. It's like I had no real conflict or problems growing. I mean, I did, but no real, it was almost like I made my own shitty reasons to get high over. It's like, I didn't really have any good reasons, but I damn sure did by the end of it. But no, it was, I don't know. It was like, I didn't really have a cause. So I guess I kind of made one, you know?
Okay.
I don't know. Yeah, I've always wondered that, and like why I did have this fierce resentment toward my dad especially, and it really was like out of nowhere. Mm. I don't know. It's just weird.
Yeah. Just wondering, because, you know, you're at the age now, you're, you know, raising kids, or I am, you know, and it seems like, you know, he wasn't doing anything wrong, and so it's just like you said, is it just like that,
not at all,
that natural just wanting to create conflict when there's no conflict, there needs to be some sort of struggle, so I don't know.
I think so. I mean, it's a mix of like boredom and wanting more out of my life and wanting something exciting. And, you know, I loved movies so much. I wanted a life like that. And I was too naive to understand that, like, that's not how things work. And thinking I wanted something that in reality is something unimaginably horrible. And like the real, it's, yeah, I really fell for the romantic idea of addiction and alcoholism and all that stuff.
So it may actually be a problem,
not
like
the reality.
So our churches were correct. It was like entertainment. We can blame the movies. You saw it on the movies, so
yeah, I'm sure a little bit. I'm sure, yeah. You know, very susceptible mind. So then, you know, that just started. You know, I was living in South Carolina at the time, and they sent me to a treatment center in Louisiana when I was 17. And that just started, like, from then I never went back home. We tried, like, what would happen was I would get periods of sobriety after treatment centers. And then I would relapse, and my parents would call the treatment center and be like, what do we do? And send them back to treatment. And so I just got stuck in this kind of washing machine of institutionalization for years. Just never, like, we would try, I think I tried to go live with my parents like one other time, and it just never worked. And the problem was, I guess some people, I was also just the way I would use, like, was so extreme, and the things that would happen, like, for example, there was a huge period in my life, like one time I got 6 months sober, and then I started taking up skateboarding, and I broke my arm really bad, and this was in Florida, back in the heyday of crooked doctors in Florida, which was crazy. So I got back on pain pills and, Xanax. That was when I first got involved in that, and went on the most ridiculous bender, and I started self-injuring myself. I gave myself a third degree burn on my hand. Like, what I would do was, I would either hit my formerly broken arm, like I would hold it in a door and slam the door on my arm, and then go to the emergency room and tell them I fell on it or something, and they give me more pain pills. One time I brewed a pot of coffee and just immediately dumped it on my hand and drove to the emergency room. But by the time I got there, my hand was like, it had cooled down and it wasn't red. And I remember sitting outside the emergency room, like, what am I going to do? And I just took out a Bic lighter and just cooked the underside of my hand, like to almost to the muscle. And then I would just take my hand to, I would drive to different cities and go to the urgent cares and just get pain pills. And the, like, I had cleaned it with, I was homeless living in hotel rooms, and I'd just been like cleaning it in the sink and putting tissue paper on it. And I remember a piece of tissue paper had started growing into my skin. And the last doctor I took my hand to, he was like, I'm not giving you pain pills and I might have to cut your hand off. And I was like, come again? Like, what? What are you talking about? And he was like, yeah, this is ungodly infected. Like, and I guess he knew what I was doing. So that was essentially the type of drug addict I was, like, unstoppable force of nature, like, I must get high at all costs. And then I was also a chronic overdoser. So I ended up overdosing 8 times, 8 hospitalized overdoses. The worst of which, I was in a coma for 4 days. I had vertigo for like 7 months after that. They had told my mom that if he wakes up, he's going to have severe brain damage and all those sorts of things. Which, you know, that's where I also get my serious faith in God and like lack of faith in doctors. Like, that really was kind of some miraculous things happen, because so many of my, and it always made me beg the question of like, why am I still here? Because I've lost so many friends to like much less extreme circumstances as far as drugs go. And I always had to wonder, like, so why, you know, why am I still here? What, you know, kind of some survivor's guilt with that. But it kind of,
you think that
became,
is kind of, you that? Think that's why you do what you do now? Because yeah. of the survivor's guilt, or a big part of it?
Well, not so, well, because, I mean, that turned into, oh, okay, maybe it's for a reason. Because it seemed to become apparent that, in my mind, or at least how I believe, God was not satisfied with letting me just be a drug addict. Because it would seem like I couldn't use successfully without these, even when I would try, I would still wake up in a hospital. And just be like, well, shit, like, what happened, you know? It was like I kept getting stopped by either the police, paramedics, friends.
It sounds...
So it was like I was fighting against the tide, really.
It sounds like the whole experience definitely strengthened your faith. How was your faith before that and while you were using? I mean, was it something that, I mean, you still believed in, was it real to you before all of this, before you died however many times?
Yeah, it was very real before, but different. And it was very real during, until a point. So around when I was 20, 23, 22, something like that, I had just been trying to get sober for so many years. Nothing seemed to work. And I, you know, heard so many times that, you know, God could heal you if you just have faith, that sort of thing, that I got finally fed up enough to say, like, I don't even believe in God anymore. I don't think any, you know, I don't believe in addiction as a disease. I don't believe in any of this crap. I feel like I've just been, because I had been put in treatment, you know, from an early age, so I never really felt like I had a chance to decide for myself. And I had always had counselors and psychiatrists tell me, this is what's wrong with you, and my parents. And I was just like, if y'all would just leave me the F alone, then I'd be fine. It's only a problem because y'all are making it a problem. That was my mindset. And at that point, I had a doctor giving me a prescription for Suboxone, Xanax, and Adderall.
Oh, man.
Like a ridiculous amount. And so I was just selling them and taking them.
That makes me mad, honestly.
Because that's
irresponsible. Like, and I'm not talking about you personally, yeah. Jed. I'm talking about to any patient. That's irresponsible. What is?
Can you explain for the lay people those three drugs, what yeah. they're for? Because three drugs for what is for psych? For
well, it's for... substance abuse and psych. Go ahead, say them again.
Okay. Yeah. I was gonna say psych, but that wasn't the right.
Go ahead,
yeah.
Judd.
Okay. Yeah. So again. He. Annie, yeah, what else? Yeah, that was...
Well, I know you just said Suboxone, Xanax.
Yeah, and I'm...
And what else?
Suboxone, Xanax, and Adderall.
Adderall!
And it was my numbers.
Amphetamines.
Listen, he...
Restricted
and listen
drug.
To the... He had me on 32 milligrams of Suboxone. And this was my daily prescription. 32 milligrams of Suboxone, 90 milligrams of Adderall, and 6 milligrams of Xanax. And he would let me... Month by month, I would ask him, I'd be like, let me just do Valium this month or Ativan this month. He would let me swap out benzos.
Do you understand? This is
insanely irresponsible.
This is why.
Why?
This is why we have a heroin epidemic. This is why opiates are killing people. It's not necessarily the drugs. I mean, it is the drugs, but it's the doctors who are prescribing the drugs. Now, I understand.
Well, the insurance companies are paying those doctors like insane amount of money just to prescribe these drugs. So,
well, that's true. And it's all run by the Food and Drug Administration.
Yeah, the pharmaceutical companies.
Out of control, FDA. Which that's a whole story in and of itself.
We're not doing that this week.
But I just...
Yeah.
That just the irresponsibility of a doctor who would do that just really bothers me.
You had a question, yep. Babe?
Yeah, so back to your what did you call it? The washing machine cycle of mm-hmm. your rehab centers. Is there any legitimacy to a rehab center? Are there pros for it? Because Omar and I worked for one and it never felt like we were doing any good.
Yeah. And so this is also, so like the history of treatment centers. So I work in them. I am a believer in them for a few reasons, because I was the type of drug addict that was not going to stop unless you locked me down. So they're very good for stabilization, right? You need to get stable so you can even make a rational decision. They really exploded during the crack epidemic, and people started getting court ordered to them, and so they needed places to go, and that's when insurance started paying, so that's when they just popped up all over the place, right? And it became this big money thing. So they went through... We're finally coming back around to the people that were like, it was basically a gold rush, and you can look up like the, especially in Florida and California and how just crooked it was, and things like patient brokering where they would like go out and find drug addicts and be like, hey, do you have insurance? And they'd be like, yeah. And they'd be like, okay, you know, come live at my house. I don't care if you relapse or whatever, we'll just keep running your insurance, and just real sick, sick things. The regulations are changing, so we're finally kind of moving away from that. There are, that said, there are good ones and there are bad ones,
right.
You know. Definitely some of them can do some harm. They can do some good. It's just really like if you put it into perspective of what your expectations are, there's no place that you can send someone to get them sober or fix their life. Doesn't exist. That's not a thing.
Yeah, I was gonna say that makes
it's gonna be on
really hard, because to say a good rehab, even like what's the percentage of, you know, relapse, or you know, what's the percentage of like, you know, staying clean, like that's, it's hard to say, like even the good ones, it's it really depends
yeah.
on the person.
Well, yeah, so. And statistics are so hard to pin down too, because it's like, how do you measure your success?
Yes,
because most
yeah.
people, even if they relapse, you know, how are they looking 5 years from now? Did they come back?
Exactly. Yeah.
All that stuff. And like I would get calls from my former rehabs and they'd be like, how are you doing? And I would like be high and I'm like, I'm doing good, man. Yeah, thanks for checking in. So but it's one of those things too where it's like you just help everyone assuming they can be helped. You know what I mean? You don't, it's, that's all you can do. And you never know, you know, like I had, you know, seeds planted all over the place from rehabs I went to that I didn't get it then, but years down the line, I like remembered what they said and it was worthwhile. So it's one of those, you just help as if you would help anyone. And then, you know, the result's going to be up to the person.
Yeah, I think that when we look at the efficiency or effectiveness of rehabilitation centers, it comes down to consistency and the long-term game plan.
Yes.
Because, you know, while 30 days or 28 days, depending on the insurance plan, up to 3 months is theoretically what we need in order to provide enough stabilization for a person to end habits and be able to approach life from a different perspective, we really need longer term services. Like, it's all about wraparound services. And I work for an insurance company, and I'm going to talk in severe vagueness because for anonymity here, but we've been
noticing
this.
Did you say reach around services?
Wraparound. It's an actual term that is used in professional places. So I'm going to talk in a lot of vagueness here, but we've been noticing this as a major problem in that we have a lot of clients who just it's a continual door where it's, you know, they go, they get their 30 days of treatment, give them 3 months, they're right back. And this keeps happening over and over and over again. And there's no real way of stepping in and getting things fixed. And so we've proposed, I'm going to talk in vagueness. Someone has proposed somewhere of providing case management through an insurance company along the process, working with every facility and the client and their families throughout, and hoping that might produce a different outcome, but I don't know. It's really hard when we look at the recidivism with substance abuse treatment.
It's fundamentally the medical and insurance world just does not understand addiction.
You can't,
speaking generally as a whole, and as far as, and there's so now the treatment is being really pushed towards medication management, things like Suboxone, and they want that to be they're starting to make places do it. And they really just assume 28 days and you're going to be fine. It's that is just so far. And honestly, sometimes that's what kills people is they would because the most common thing for people to die is going to a 7-14, 28 day detox, getting their tolerance back to baseline, then they leave and try to do the same amount they did before they came in and they die. That happens all of the time. And the problem is the most effective thing that works is go to a 30 day treatment and then do 6 to 9 to 18 months of structured sober living or something to where you it like a phase system where you start out with limited
different levels of care, step down services.
Right. And so it's you're slowly easing back into society. The problem, the biggest problem, and if I could fix it, it would just be making that affordable, because it's not cheap, especially if you're under 18 and you can't support yourself. And the whole thing is if drug addicts had 10 grand, they wouldn't be trying to get clean, but it's just not realistic. And the state run facilities are usually I've been to a few that are really good. Most of them, you'll have the model where they're just work camps where I went to one where they had contracts. They're actually being sued now for labor law violations, but they had contracts with, I worked in a cayenne pepper factory on an assembly line. I built porta potties, worked at a billboard company. This was all at the same treatment center. They just had all these contracts where they're like, hey, we've got workers that you can pay $250 an hour, an hour, and they don't pay us anything. So but we are, quote, paying for our treatment. So we would just work 40 to 60 hours a week.
Wow. That's crazy.
So that's a model. Yeah. Or they'll have businesses. That's kind of the teen challenge model, is that they have thrift stores, and they make candles and like leather goods, so you'll just go work for them.
Yeah, that's the program that me and Elizabeth worked for, was a Dream Center. I mean, and they were great people, the people who ran it, and I would even almost consider that a successful rehab program, although I know a lot of people who obviously were still struggling who, you know, graduated from the program, and others who maybe didn't graduate and are doing well, but, you know, that like you said, they were teaching some decent life skills, and it was faith-based. It was,
yeah, totally.
It was faith-based, you know, so however you want to, like, you know, wherever, I mean, so it was good.
Yeah, and some of those too, like if you're, so that one that I'm speaking of, that one was really good. They were really in deep with the court system, and your record would, I mean, there were people in there facing, you know, 20, 30 years, and if you completed their program, you're good. And so, like, that's awesome. Some of these, if you're homeless or indigent and like you will leave that, like part one of the stipulations is you have to have a car, $3,000 in a bank account and housing. So it's like, you know, they can do some real good. The biggest problem I see is just affordable quality care for extended periods of time, because it's so much more complex than go to this place for X amount of days and then like see you later. Yeah,
and,
like,
and also shout out to the Dream Center also, because they were free. And so it was like,
yeah,
so they awesome. Weren't making money from insurance companies or anything for having people there. And that's one of the things, as Seth was talking about, just being in that world of insurance and looking at it from the mental health or, you know, the disease side of things, of the addiction. It's scary because then it starts becoming a case. They're looked at as cases and not people. And then it's almost like once you start sending somebody to these facilities represented by the insurance company, it almost seems like they're there watching their money more than they're there, you know, to be invested more into the lives of people. And speaking of faith-based, and, you know, you've talked about how important that was with you and to keep you sober and your whole sobriety road. How important do you think that is? Because we talked about how these facilities or these programs are hit or miss, you know, they may or may not work. And you personally, it seems like you contribute a lot of your sobriety to your relationship with you know, you're a creator with Jesus or whatever. And so I don't mean
whatever.
Jesus. I don't mean Jesus. Exactly.
Come
I don't mean
on,
it. That,
Omar.
I don't mean it that way.
Show
I'm just
some
saying.
Respect to the Father.
Put some respect. Well,
respect. We are actually, we started this early. And by the way, Saints just beat the Panthers.
Yep. I saw that. So I'm good.
So wait, who was cheering for who? Who won? Who lost? Who's top? Who's
the
bottom?
Saints, dude. Saints all the way.
So anyway, so Jesus loves you more apparently today.
Yeah, that's true.
Because I said whatever, he saw that coming. See, he knows all.
Yep.
Anyway, that's my question though. I want to tie that into recovery and staying sober, because it's like, how then if we don't want to, like, yes, go to the programs. Programs are good, but they're not the answer. Yes, drugs are good. They're not the answer. So what would you say somebody really needs to, like, basically stay sober for the long haul? Like, what are the key ingredients, would you say?
Yeah. How do you do it? How do you get sober? pretty much change your entire life. Yeah. So this is another thing that and there's a whole movement now called alt recovery, which,
alternative. Is that what that's supposed to signify?
Yep. But it's alt recovery.
Original.
There are so
what does that mean? You just start smoking weed instead?
No, that's called California sober. That's a thing too. Cali sober is you're sober but you smoke weed. That's another movement. There's also high sobriety. Yeah, there's so you've got 12-step traditional 12-step recovery, which I 12-step abstinence based recovery, which I am a personal believer that's the best way. Well, there's so many caveats with it too. So if you are, This is the other problem with the treatment industry, was that everyone that came through the door of treatment, they will tell you that you are an alcoholic and a drug addict. That's not true. And what happened was, then you had those people going into 12-step recovery meetings saying what they did to get sober, which 5 times out of 10 is a complete load of bullshit, and it's not going to work for an actual alcoholic. And so that's how the waters kind of got polluted. And then you have those people kind of spreading their little gospel of, this is how I got sober, when in reality that is not going to work for the 1% of the 10% that are just straight up alcoholic drug addicts. I believe the only way you're going to get sober is by having a spiritual experience and working the 12 steps of recovery. If you are now, I've also seen and met people that have had just straight up white light conversion experiences and never looked back. I've seen some people, it's a tricky thing. It's also like my Christianity in that, like, it's my beliefs have changed and they're always constantly evolving, because primarily I don't want you to die. And my goal is that if you are having a better quality of life and you're staying alive, then I'm okay with that. And hopefully at some point you will stay alive long enough to get wherever you're going. And hopefully that goal is abstinence and you know, because a lot of people will still try to dip their toes in the water and maybe do this or that. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. The whole thing is that, like, the best case scenario is it works. The worst case scenario is you die. So it's a pretty big wager that you're doing. So for me personally, there was no way I was getting sober without spiritual help. No way at all. And really, that's what I attribute it to completely, because I couldn't. The only reason I could tell you why I finally got it was that I didn't do anything. It really was God, doing it for me. And then, initially, and then I do the work, the maintenance work, which is, if I had to break it down to its simplest terms, it's trust God, clean house, help others. And those are the key. Helping others is the biggest key. Trusting God is the biggest key, and cleaning house is the biggest key. So it's taking constant inventory of my thoughts and actions. It's making sure to have a regimen of prayer and meditation. And it's making sure to help spread the message when I'm asked, and sometimes when I'm not. And that can look like sharing my story at a meeting, doing something like this, sponsoring other people. I get calls all the time from friends and family members asking for help. You know, the answer is always yes. And that, you know, on a practical level, that does a ton of things. The farther away I get from the last time I got high, the easier it is to forget how shitty it was. And my mind will, you know, I'm 5 years sober and I'm by no means safe. It's harder in a lot of ways because, like, I'm a counselor, dude. Like, I could smoke some weed. Like, what's the big deal? Those are the thoughts I have. You know, it's always, you know, I have a monster inside of me that's always trying to kill me. And it always will. So when I work with someone who just smoked crack yesterday, I can look at them and be like, oh yeah, it sucks. That's what that's like. I remember that. So that's the practical benefit of that. And then there's something about getting outside of yourself and helping someone else that I'm not thinking about my dumb stuff when I'm talking to you. And then, you know, making sure that my spiritual maintenance is maintained is the other big piece, so that when all else fails, you know, and sometimes before then, but God can step in and do for me what I can't do for myself, right? Because sometimes I'm just physically, you know, like, I can have all the phone numbers in the world, but if I can't pick up the phone and call them, then it's useless, right? Sometimes you need that extra push. So it really, it's, you got to figure out if you truly believe that you are alcoholic, that you do have this thing. And I do believe it to be a disease, and I try not to get tripped up on the language. It really doesn't matter. It's some sort of disorder of the, that centers in the brain. You know, it is a brain disease. If you think that's you, then you figure out what you're willing to do. And then you just, you know, do that. That's probably the other problem with it, is there is, like, you know, a common solution, but there isn't. I mean, everybody's got to kind of find what works for them long term, because it's easy to burn out on doing recovery and stuff like that, and you really got to figure out ways to keep it fresh in your mind.
One of the things you said earlier too, Jed, I think is huge, and I'm not sure exactly where you put that in the triangle you were just discussing, but holy fuck, I just lost it. I lost my question.
Trusting God, cleaning house, helping others. You lost it.
Go ahead, Seth. I'm sorry.
Something I found really important in what you shared is that really a large key to your recovery is your support system.
That's exactly what it was.
You even mentioned, you know, how you can have all the phone numbers in your phone, but if you don't have the strength to call somebody, then it's not even, you know, you got to have that. So we got to start with at least the desire to change. Maybe not, you know, when we look at the stages of change, pre-contemplation, it's part of the stages. So, I think that was important, and really having people you can reach out to, I think is super key.
Right. And don't smoke weed, kids, either, because that's where I was, short-term memory there. But that was my question. You said something about how, you know, just basically changing everything you do. And with that, is it also having friends who surround you, like Seth was saying, support system? That was kind of the same direction I was going.
Yes,
like,
that. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up too, because it's, it's incredible too. So, like, I went to this treatment center in 2005, and if you know anything about rehab stats, they're not good. But out of that treatment center in 2005. There are five of us that are still best friends. One of them was the best man in my wedding. If I ever have a kid, he'll be the godfather. And only one of them, Dirty Mike, he's been on our show. He's stayed sober the whole time. The rest of us have gone in and out, but now we're all sober, and we all live in the same city now. We were all from different states, so it's pretty crazy. But yes, I have people in my life that it would be extraordinarily difficult for me to fall off the map these days without people stopping by, calling me, where are you, what are you doing? If I show up somewhere and I look high, you know, or something, they're going to ask, you know what I'm saying? Like, I have a very strong system of people that will call me on my shit, and I allow them to, and I call them on their shit, and that's how that works. I think that's so important, to have people that if you don't show up, they're going to call you and say, where are you at? You know, what are you doing? Are you okay? All that.
Transparency and accountability.
Yes.
Cool. Very cool. Very cool. Yes. Thank you. No,
you were muted.
I was muted. Yeah. And honestly, Jed, it's 4:45. I'm not sure. You said it's about the time for you to go, but I mean, it's been a pleasure. I've really had you on. We've got covered a lot in a short amount of time, like really a lot revolved around your story. I love what you're doing. I really, every time we get a chance to talk to you, you know, you bring your A game, whether we're talking conspiracy theories or, you know, or mental health. And so,
You got to have crazy hobbies too. That's the thing. But yeah, and if anyone, yeah, so like my show is Church and Other Drugs, but if anybody out there needs help with anything or has questions or what do I do or anything like that, anything related to this, email me at churchandotherdrugs@gmail.com. Or you can reach out if it's a super personal or you need me quick, reach out to Omar and get like my cell number or messenger, any of that. Please reach out anytime. I'm always there for that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And obviously this has been a very short conversation. We've just kind of started the conversation. Hopefully that's the biggest thing. If you're hearing this right now and you're struggling and you think you might need help, get help, you know, talk to somebody that you trust. You know, if you don't have that, please reach out to, like you said, either Jed or myself. Obviously we have our Patreon. You don't have to join the Patreon. If you need help, please reach out, you know, to our Facebook directly. You can find us, you know, Fade to Gray Podcast on Facebook or on Instagram, and, or just get help, you know, like, you know, and, it's going to be hard, but it's worth it. And so, Jed, I appreciate you. Seth, you had something? I heard that sigh.
Yeah, I sighed. No, I was going to say, you know, we say, oh, get help, you know, and I just want to mention, you might not be ready to say get help at the moment. And I want you to know that that's okay. But,
yeah.
But, you know, there is a lot to be said in having the conversation, reaching out and asking yes. for help. You may not know the right answer or know that you need help at this time. But if you think that potentially talking about this could be supportive, I want you to do that too. Because as we talk, as we share things, we learn more about ourselves and more about our path and the things that are going to be best for us. And Jed, I just want to thank you so much for coming on for this conversation.
Yeah, for sure, man. Love y'all, man. I appreciate the chance.
Yeah. And as he mentioned, reach out to Jed if needed. Until next time.
Yeah. Yep. See you guys
later. Thanks, man. What is up, Fade to Gray friends and family? It's your boy Omar here, and I got to edit this episode. I want to personally thank each one of you for listening to our new Binge Bowl series on health, as well as Dan Koch for this dope new intro and outro music. If you like what you hear and need new music for your podcast or small business, or big business with that, he has a website, dankoch.net, that's dankoch.net, with lots of quality tunes to choose from. Go check him out. And if you're enjoying this health series as much as we have, please don't hesitate to let us know, give us a 5-star review, hit that like button and a comment. And if you're interested in becoming a friend and family of Fade to Gray, you can do that at patreon.com. So please come check us out. And have a happy new year. Stay healthy, my friend.